several things in our practice are relevant to what we want to be reflecting on tonight and through this sequence. For example, we began, as always, by observing our breath. You were also listening, or not, to what was being said. You were perhaps looking, and I mean, I'm looking at you, and you're looking here, so we're all seeing each other. And just to say something very obvious but very important, as soon as we look, as soon as we open our eyes or hear a sound, we are involved willy-nilly in a kind of subject-object situation. Are we not? You are not me, and I am not you. Your ears are not the sound, but you are hearing sound. Your eyes are not the sight. Your eye consciousness is not the sight. Different philosophical takes on that, but I'm just talking about our ordinary sense of experience. So there's a seeing and there's something seen. There's a hearing and a something heard, and a hearer too. These three things. Subject and object. And would you not say that our life's experience is fundamentally structured around some kind of subject and object? Because that's how our senses work. We see something, but we are not that thing. We are a seer of that thing. And then there's something that we call seeing that somehow seems to connect the seer and the seen. And we'll worry a little bit later about how that might work. And also, when we began to reflect on love, love is always a question of, pretty much always, again, in the world of ordinary experience, love is, there's a beloved and a lover, and then there's the loving. There is me and you. There is self and other. Very basic categories. Self and other, subject and object. Self and other is a subset of subject and object. And that's all very fine and good. We have to know how to maneuver and see things and so on. What we come to recognize in terms of practice is that this business of what's going on between subject and object, a way of understanding self and other, what is self? What is other? What do they have to do with each other? These are frownable questions. What is she talking about? All I'm talking about now is just identifying something very fundamental to our everyday experience. Self and other. Subject and object. There's a kind of two-ness there. Two-ness. And when we look into whether we are cultivating wisdom or whether we are cultivating love and compassion on our way to developing bodhicitta, this heartfelt, urgent quest for full illumination, full awakening, so that we can have that to share with others. Whether we're looking at compassion or wisdom, this business of self and other, subject and object, is very, very central. Wisdom, we sang this very famous verse to evoking the perfection of wisdom. Wisdom, we always hear, is non-dual. That means wisdom's way of understanding subject and object is not our way. And we're practitioners, we're seekers, or at least we're curious about what other ways there might be to live in the world than the one we seem to be stuck in right now. And so we're interested in this wisdom. Wisdom is not a dualist experience. Ma sam jeme shera parashin. We said that it's not something that is expressible in ordinary ways. It's not about thinking. Whatever wisdom is, it's not about thinking. Because thinking always divides the world into thinker and thought of. As soon as we have any sense of I, which we all have, the universe is split into self and other. Bodhicitta, this ultimate kind of loving intention that we are seeking to cultivate, is another way of undoing the bifurcation, the divide between subject and object and self and other. It's kind of a big topic, and it's helpful to recognize at the outset that it's relevant to wisdom and compassion. We are, in this sequence, we have talked about both wisdom and compassion in other past years. We talked about the four boundless states recently, and they're still present for us as important subjects to explore. In this context, in this sequence, we particularly want to look at the connection between compassion and wisdom and how compassion leads to wisdom.
And?
Wisdom leads to compassion, of course. So was that myself talking? Or was that my other self? My better self?
A bearded version.
Certainly saying something that was in my mind, but yet I was going to say something else. So to hear him say what I was not going to say, as if I was going to say it, then I right away have, wait a second, self other thing. This is... So, Kanja Rinpoche, in his commentary on the Treasury of Precious Qualities, which some of you have read that chapter on compassion, is this beautiful, he has a couple of beautiful things that he says. He says that compassion is nothing but the glow and radiance of wisdom. Compassion is the radiance of wisdom. And particularly, compassion leads to the wisdom of precise discrimination. Wisdom, you may know, and if you don't know yet, you will know soon if you stick around. Wisdom in the Buddhist tradition, we speak of five wisdoms. They're really one thing, but they have different kinds of qualities. So wisdom has the quality of very precise discrimination. This is not cogitating. This is not, creating logarithms or computer programs, that kind of thing that some of you are really good at. That is akin to wisdom, right? Because you do have very keen discrimination when you do that kind of work. This is perhaps discrimination of another order. But in any case, compassion is connected with the wisdom of discrimination. And love, Kanji Rinpoche also says, love is, of course, a sense of, as we sang earlier today, just as compassion is the wish that everyone be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, as we always sing, that's our aspiration, that's why we practice, is so that this might be so, love yearns that oneself and everyone should have happiness and the causes of happiness. And this, and Kanji Rinpoche also says, by meditating on the, by when we recognize, what is love? Its essence is empty. You can't, you know, grab onto love or any other mental state. And realizing that this love, which is a major central purpose of our practice to experience, to cultivate, to grow, to extend, to share with others. This love is, through cultivating it, one gains the, he calls it the unobstructed mirror-like wisdom. There's something unobstructed about love. How many songs do we have that tell us that love, you know, will move through mountains, cross oceans? There is that feeling. Love is, if there's anything that seems ready to bridge the distance between subject and object, self and other, love seems like a pretty good candidate. Creates a sense of connection with others, caring. And it's connected with a mirror. So what's the quality of a mirror? The quality of a mirror, speaking of mirror-like wisdom, it has tremendous clarity. Tremendous clarity. It reflects every detail without distortion. So love sees what is and loves it. So just like we had this moment of exploring the possibility of a loving being at our crown, just seeing us exactly as we are, with all our flaws and gaffes and knowing completely all the, you know, not so great things we've all done in our lifetime. Not looking away from that, but loving us. Not feeling that we are those flaws, but that seeing that we have a nature, a luminous nature, that is in fact already perfect. And this is always a very important reference for us in the Buddhist tradition that, you know, it might seem, well, I'm pretty grouchy most of the time. I blow my stack a lot, you know, becoming a totally loving person. And anyway, I've got to look out for my own interests and, you know, keep my boundaries very proper. I don't really like to get too close to most people. All these things come up. We have resistance to love. And that's why I mention that, because who knows, maybe you were feeling that as we did that exercise, and that's actually good. If that's something that's true for you, it's good to feel it. So, so three things. We have a nature which is unflawed, just like clear water. You can throw stuff into it, you know, when we say the water is dirty, but the water isn't really dirty. There's junk in the water. That's the problem. All you have to do is get rid of it. The water is already fine. And our nature is like that. It's already fine. It's already perfect. It's not actually stained by all the things that we're so embarrassed about remembering that we did and fear that we will continue to do. Those are actions, but they're not our nature. That background's everything. And every once in a while, we stop and talk about that more extensively. Tonight, I'm just pointing to it. But it's important because it means that we have the possibility for a profound shift. Now, both of these images of love and compassion, which are part of the traditional discussion of love and compassion, mirror-like wisdom, leading to a mirror-like wisdom, leading to wisdom of very precise discrimination, shows us something that experience, I think, also shows us, which is that there is some connection between love and compassion and clarity, freshness of experience. Love and compassion are not ideas, even though we think about them as part and talk about them as part of our a way of developing. But part of what happens when we have compassion, let us say, is that we are allowing ourselves to actually see someone as they are in this moment in pain. Something's wrong. Which is very different from... We have two kinds of our mind. We have two kinds of minds. One is a mind which sees things directly in this moment. Our senses do that. And the other, a very powerful function of mind, is it freeze frames things and people so that we don't see them freshly. Now, when I walked into this room earlier, haven't been here for, I'm not sure, 6 weeks, 5 or 6 weeks or so, and I thought, oh, it looks different. Maybe it really is different, or maybe I just remembered it differently. But the fact is that usually when I walk into a room that I've been in many times before, it's the same old, same old. Why? Because I have freeze-framed it. This is what the temple looks like. Yeah, it looks the same. Well, there's this nice projection on here that Gary and/or Claire put up at my request earlier, and we'll refer to it briefly later. But, you know, same old thing, and we see each other. Oh, there's so-and-so. Oh, yeah, there they are. There's that person I never talked to. There's that person I like to talk to. And it's not fresh. Or we hear about certain categories of people. People who have certain kinds of jobs or live in certain neighborhoods or voted a certain way or believe this or that or read certain kinds of books or like certain kinds of movies. Those people, you know what I mean? Those people. It's a generalizing function of mind that is not seeing precisely, not seeing clearly. And love and compassion can't really open unless there is presence in the moment to what is actually occurring. We have fantasies of, you know, being loving. And actually, those fantasies are quite important. They can be helpful. But they're not direct experience. So one of the things that we really wanted to highlight this evening and continuing is the importance of the freshness of the present moment, how somebody really is. You know, we think we know people and we don't bother to really freshly look. How are you now? How are you today? I mean, I know this myself, you know, it's kind of, oh, hello, hello. And we have a idée fixée, you know, this just fixed idea. This is so-and-so. They've always been so-and-so. They always will be so-and-so. And part of that comes because we have also reified what we think we are. But we're all always changing. This means that the understanding of impermanence, which we have talked about before in different contexts, recognizing impermanence, the freshness of experience, that you can never step in the same river twice. That example is also part of Buddhist lore as well as Greek. You cannot. You cannot. You can't relive the same moment twice. And yet, we have a way of reifying, freeze-framing, so that we lose the aliveness of the present moment. So this is an important topic for us as it relates both to wisdom and compassion, because this is a key contributor. This freeze-framing, as it were, is a key contributor to the sense of an overly structured subject and object divided world, which prevents us from fully experiencing the ocean of reality that, from the perspective of the teachings that we are encountering, we are always swimming in. So it's extremely, this distinction and its relationship to impermanence are extremely important, both for the wisdom understanding how things are, how our minds are, and for the opening up of the heart to love and compassion.
Anne has touched on several themes that I think we'll be weaving back and forth during the course of the 8 sessions we'll have. And I want to frame them slightly from my perspective, but it's really within the same context, but trying to highlight what we're bringing forward and perhaps getting it from 2 different perspectives will be helpful. The first is the absolute centrality of freshness, reality, present, presence, as opposed to thought, freeze framing, reification, expectation, concept, unchanging, prejudgment. Freshness, aliveness, as opposed to prejudgment and concept. Reality as opposed to concept. Now, it turns out associated with reality and freshness is also ultimately this realization of the ocean of reality that Anne talked about, with the ultimate bodhicitta that Anne has talked about, with non-dual wisdom, which we'll be talking about. So these are all kind of great words, and they're inspiring, as opposed to duality, thought, conceptuality, frozenness, rigidity. And I think a lot of us, including me, have a kind of presupposition that I want to flag based on something that Anne said early in the teaching. And that is, well, this unbounded ocean, this limpid lucidity, this non-duality, that in order to jump to that, I shouldn't get involved with details. It's kind of like what I was doing during my graduate studies, and I was fresh to Buddhism. And of course, in graduate school, you're supposed to learn a hell of a lot of details. But I had the idea that basically Buddhist meditation was to keep your mind open and free and space-like. So I spent 4 years in the Student Union building and failed my preliminary examinations. And my dear thesis advisor kind of, in so many words, basically said, "What happened?" And I said, "I was keeping my mind empty." Because, you know, if you were going towards non-duality and oceanic limpid lucidity, why bother with all those books? It's not uncommon. But here's a key that really is important to contemplate and refresh and remember over and over again. There is a capacity of the mind that as you focus on something, and yes, initially when you are focusing, there's going to be some dualism involved, that with focusing, you can move to a kind of stabilization, a kind of focus, and then there can be an opening up into a panoramic consciousness that's very different from our ordinary dualistic consciousness. So what might seem contraindicated Because this non-dual, oceanic, limpid lucidity sounds so wonderful. You know, how do I just kind of dissolve into this jello-like state? Well, in a kind of counterintuitive manner, it often involves drilling down into a lot of details and a lot of specifics. And so it's actually in this third line, in the homage to Mother Wisdom, it says, field of precise wisdom and presence. In Tibetan, it's Sosur Dokpe Yeshe. It's like the wisdom, the non-dual wisdom that knows all the specifics. And that in itself is very, very hard to sort of grasp. And we don't have to break our minds around it, but it's just that wisdom is not a blob. Wisdom can be very, very specific in its content. And so within this freshness, within this immediacy, within this clarity that we are cultivating, we are really not wanting to zone out and space out into this kind of oceanic state, kind of hopping into that, but we're actually using a ladder with a million steps, and we're valuing every single specific step. I was talking last night with Anne, and we have some jokes between ourselves. There's a school of Hindu philosophy, which is called the Vaisheshikas, and their specialization is just making differences between things. Visheshas are like differences. They're just kind of logic choppers. And then I basically said to Anne, you know, everybody in India is a Vaisheshika. And it's true. I mean, you look at whether it be Buddhists or Hindus or Advaita or all the schools of Indian philosophy, or you look at Indian grammar, I mean, it's all amazing logic chopping. But with the logic chopping, they're often going beyond duality. Duality destroys itself. So my first pitch is, don't get worried if we're getting into a lot of details. We don't want to leave you stuck in the details, but it's a kind of details can be a path to a non-detailed, non-dual, panoramic unfolding. So if you find yourself having resistance and saying, I want that non-dual jello that he's talking about, I just want to kind of become, you know, the fruit pieces in the jello. That's lovely. I mean, that's a deep kind of spiritual longing that we actually all have. It's kind of a natural desire to return home. It's lovely. You can touch into that. And it might involve, you know, going through every little chocolate chip one at a time. So what Anne said that triggered all of this was that our sensory experiences, our feelings in our body are in the present. It's absolutely mind-blowing. None of us can really, unless we're pretty together and pretty enlightened and pretty aware, most of us walk around thinking that, you know, yesterday is sort of somewhere back there on that side or maybe back there, and the future is somewhere out there. And like, can you really get that, like, we're on this razor's edge of the present? That's like, you want to contemplate one thing, just contemplate the present. Everything else is gone. Nothing else has happened. And the physicists can only give you probabilities about what the hell's happening in this moment. In our experience on the subjective side of things, and one of the big challenges is we live in an objectified culture. Everything we talk about is objectified. Even when you think you're talking to me about your subjective experience, most people will talk to me about objective stuff. What are you feeling in your knee? Well, there's a bone and it's got ligaments. You don't know what ligaments and bone. What are you feeling? Bones and ligaments are not feelings. You want to bust your mind a little bit? Just think about what the difference between a bone and ligament and your actual experience of your knee is. Start there. So when we go with our sensations, we are getting as close to the present in our bodies as we can. So our bodies are a free entree into present time. Amazing. Most of us don't value it. In academia, they certainly don't value it, except some people. You know, let's go into our head and let's think. Most people, when we ask them, what are you feeling in your body? They look at us like, you know, we just landed from Mars. So there are three things, at least, which sensing into your current experience can do for you. And I'm going to let you know. The first is, you're getting lost in your thoughts, da 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 da, and you want that unbounded, limpid lucidity, that non-dual experience. Well, guess what? Actually, being in the present is a step towards that. And the quickest way into the present is your physical experiences. Number two, most people writing about emotions will let you know that emotions are some reaction to some event in the world that impacts our bodies, and there's usually some kind of action tendency that's arising in response to that event. So if you want to know who you are and what you are and what you're all about, your body is usually, unless you're kind of stuffed up because people told you not to feel anything for most of your life, which most of us are. But if you start getting used to sensing into your body, you're going to have a clearer sense of what the heck you're feeling, which can be very, very useful in general. That's the second benefit from sensing into your body. What's the third? The third comes from the Theravada tradition, from a great commentator who wrote this encyclopedia of meditation. His name is Buddha Ghosa, which means the voice of Buddha. The commentary is called The Path of Purification. It's a great book. Some of it's very, very hard. Some of it's very, very useful. It's only about, 800, 900 pages long. But he makes a great observation, and I think it's even in a footnote to that book. And it goes like this, that as the body becomes clear, the mind becomes clear. And there are practices in Theravada Buddhism where you're actually sensing into your body very, very carefully, very, very carefully. And as you do those, the more carefully you notice your body, the more carefully you're aware of your mind. And what the nature of the mind is ultimately very, very interesting to us. So if you want to understand mind better, there's no quicker way to understand it than through recognizing your body. So some of the things we'll be doing over the course of 8 weeks is really trying to help all of us move out of our mind concept, reified, frozen, freeze-fried, freeze-dried, freeze-framed, present, you know, that just is stuck about ourselves and others, and into a richer sense of self and other. The richer the sense of ourself, of self and other, richer in the sense of clearer, more granular, more imbued with wisdom, ultimately you might feel a thinning of the boundaries between self and other. It's a bit paradoxical, but usually you're not going to have a sense of, okay, here's myself, and I'm going to beat myself into a sense of non-duality with this strong sense of selfhood. It's a paradox that, you know, it just is a game without end. typically much more typical in terms of non-dual experiences or dissolution of sense of self and other. These are kind of fruitional arrivals where you might all of a sudden recognize, oh, I've been in a kind of open spaciousness, which I didn't intend, plan, make happen. There was a kind of an arrival or a descent or a fruition. Because if we're sort of chugging, and, you know, I'm going to make something happen, we're just reinforcing, can be reinforcing a sense of self. But there's, of course, a lot of doing and practice and dualism on the way to non-dualism. So just as a kind of entree experiment in terms of ordinary mind and something a little bit fresher, I'm going to do a guided meditation with people. I will just be curious. It might fail. Might be okay. Okay, so you can sit and bring somebody to mind who you kind of really care about. Just sort of bring somebody to mind who you really care about and just see how your mind is, how your body is, how your heart is. Just see how your sense of love or compassion is towards this person. You know, is this person some kind of like a fixed image for you? Or is there a lot of sense of vivacity to it? Or is it just kind of a fixed? And just rest with that for some moment. And just imagine and see what occurs to you if you learn that this person has been diagnosed with stomach cancer and they've been given 2 or 3 weeks to live. What occurs in your experience? You recognize that they have 2 or 3 weeks. Then they'll be no longer part of this world. What's happening in your body? What's happening in your heart? What's happening in your mind? Just take in what it's like when you appreciate that this person might be get such a diagnosis and really have a limited time with us. Okay, so you can return to this room. And this is just an instance of how the teachings on impermanence, which are part of the Buddhist teachings on wisdom, may relate to teachings on love and compassion.
If you enjoyed this teaching, please visit our website, donmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness in its causes. May all beings always be free of pain in its causes.